Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and get your first month free. Just $1 down, $15 a month. No commitment. Deal ends Friday, February 13th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
When Pascal Hughes, founder and CEO of Noiser Podcasts, came to me with the idea of a daily history podcast, I thought he was mad. Just absolutely bonkers. Both he and I have produced quality history podcasts before, shows like American History Tellers or Real Dictators, and these shows take a lot of effort. How could you possibly try to squeeze in the same level of storytelling, the same rigor of research, the same production quality into a 20-minute show, and then do it 5 days a week forever? But I also knew Pascal might be mad like a scientist, a kooky but brilliant mind who's discovered the key to another dimension. And let me tell you, History Daily is indeed another dimension. Everything I feared about how hard a daily podcast might be has turned out to be true. But here we are, still doing it, telling the most fascinating stories from history every day. But we are by far not the only ones with the gumption enough to try it. There are other very brave podcasters who have decided The Daily Show is the hill they're going to die on, like Gary Arndt and his podcast, Everything Everywhere, which has over 650 episodes and comes out 7 days a week. But Everything Everywhere is about as aptly named a podcast as it could be. Name a topic and Gary has an episode on it. And all of them are delightful, short, well-researched, and fascinating. And the two episodes we're spotlighting today's Saturday matinee, another double feature, are exemplary specimens of what makes the show so good. Just like a box of chocolates, you never know what you're going to get. And in that spirit, I'm not even going to tell you the topics. Listen, find out, and enjoy. And afterward, be sure to search for and follow Everything Everywhere for more 7 days a week. We put a link in the show notes to make it easy for you. In the year 1900, a crew of sponge divers was looking for sponges off of the coast of the Greek island of Antikythera. While they were searching, they found the remains of an ancient shipwreck. The wreck contained over 30 marble statues, some pieces of glasswork, some coins, and a corroded metal object that nobody could identify. 75 years later, using new technology, they discovered what the hunk of metal was designed for. Learn more about the Antikythera mechanism and how it forever changed our view of the ancient world on this episode of Everything Everywhere Daily. As with most archaeological discoveries, the Antikythera wreck was totally discovered by accident. It was the year 1900, and a Greek ship that was heading to hunt for sponges in North Africa took shelter near the island of Antikythera during a storm. Antikythera is located between the island of Crete and mainland Greece. And in Greek, it simply means the opposite of Kythera, which is the name of the larger island nearby. Antikythera has always been a pretty small island. During the Ottoman period, they never even bothered to conquer it because it was so small it wasn't deemed to be worth their time. While the Greek sponge divers were there, they decided to dive down to see if they could find any sponges. One of the divers, Elias Stadiatis, went down at one site that was 45 meters deep, or about 150 feet. They were diving with those old-timey diving helmets and canvas suits that were attached to an air hose at the surface. As soon as he got down to the bottom, he signaled back to the men on the boat that he needed the surface. When he got to the surface, he was terrified. He spoke of seeing piles of corpses and horses littering the seafloor. To be fair, there isn't a whole lot of light at 150 feet below the surface, and he was wearing a diving helmet. And he also wasn't totally wrong. He did see bodies and horses. It's just that they happened to be statues. What they had found was the wreck of a Roman-era ship that had sunk just off the coast of Antikythera. The shipwreck, known as the Antikythera Wreck, was a literal treasure trove. Over the next several years, divers returned to the site, beginning to salvage everything they could find at the bottom of the sea. The next year, in 1901, they found a bronze sculpture called the Youth of Antikythera. They found an additional 30 marble sculptures.
In addition to the sculptures, they found glasswork, 3 sculptures of a horse, a lyre made of bronze, assorted pottery, coins, jewels, and a collection of lead pipes. One theory holds that the ship was carrying items to be used in a triumph for Julius Caesar. Another theory is that it was returning booty for the Roman general Sulla, who had sacked Athens. But there's probably no way to ever know the truth. The thing is, there was something else that was found, and no one was really sure what it was. It basically looked like a lump of corroded metal that maybe was attached to some wood. All of the artifacts salvaged from the wreck were sent to the National Museum of Archaeology in Athens, where they were placed in storage for later analysis. The statues got most of the attention, and the recovered lump of metal was mostly ignored. However, a year later, one of the archaeologists took a closer look at the object and noticed something odd. It appears that embedded in that lump was a metal gear. Despite that very interesting and very odd observation, the metal clump was once again ignored, this time for decades. Over time, the fragile object broke into many pieces, 82 of them to be precise. Most of them were pretty small, but there was still one major piece that was intact. Interest in the object surfaced again in 1951, when a Yale University physicist named Derek DeSola Price concluded that the device was for predicting astronomical events. He said it was an ancient analog computer. The real breakthrough occurred in 1971. Price and a Greek nuclear physicist named Charalampos Karakalos subjected the object to a series of tests using X-rays and gamma-ray scanning. What they found was a whole bunch of gears that were inside. Masterfully created bronze gears that all seemed to fit together. While much of the original device was missing, there appeared to have been approximately 30 gears. The problem was, this didn't make any sense. Based on everything we knew about the Greeks, they didn't have this sort of technology. Metallic gears like this weren't supposed to be invented for several more centuries. This was the type of stuff you would normally see in a mechanical clock, and as far as we knew, there weren't any mechanical clocks in the ancient world. Now dubbed the Antikythera mechanism, it became an object of fascination for many people around the world. Jacques Cousteau went to dive the wreck site in 1976 and found a few small bronze pieces which might have been a part of the original mechanism. Nobel Prize-winning physicist Richard Feynman visited the National Museum in Athens and found it all rather boring, except for the Antikythera mechanism. About it, he said it was, quote, so entirely different and strange that it is nearly impossible. It's some kind of machine with gear trains, very much like the inside of a modern wind-up alarm clock, end quote. There was still a great deal of debate as to what the purpose of the device was. In 2006, another analysis of the mechanism discovered something else. There was writing on it in the most common form of ancient Greek. It appeared to have been an instruction manual for the device, which references dials and functions. The text is incomplete, but what characters are on it supports this interpretation. In 2016, yet more inscriptions were found which referenced 462-year and 442-year periods, which were the same as the Greek synodic periods for Venus and Saturn. And this was based on their geocentric view of the world. Over time, the consensus converged on what the obvious purpose of the device was. It was an astronomical calculator. Based on the pieces we have and the characters found on the device, people have been able to largely reconstruct the mechanism and how it might have worked. The device was a rectangle, about the size of a large dictionary or a mantle clock. There were dials on both sides of the device. On one side were pointers like the hands of a clock that moved around and showed the location of the sun, moon, phases of the moon, and the known planets. On the other side were 2 dials. One dial calculated the metonic cycle. The metonic cycle is the 19-year cycle that phases of the moon go through. It covers 235 moon cycles, which takes you to a point where the phases are back in the same time of year. And the cycle is only an hour and a half off of a perfect 19 years. The second dial indicates the Saros cycle. The Saros cycle is a 223-month-long cycle that calculates solar and lunar eclipses, and it is about 18 and a half years long. There may have been as many as 42 different astronomical events that were tracked by the device. The entire device was operated by a crank on the side, which you turn to run everything backwards or forwards in time. In addition to virtual versions of the Antikythera mechanism, there have been several actual versions built by enthusiasts. They differ slightly because there are parts missing, but they're able to achieve basically the same thing using the knowledge of the gears that we have. Knowing what the Antikythera mechanism does, however, seems to raise more questions than it answers. And the big one is, why have we never found anything like this before? There were some ancient authors which made allusions to devices that might have acted like a planetarium. Archimedes supposedly created a device called an orrery, which was spheres of the known planets, the moon and the sun, which rotated about the Earth. And he also supposedly wrote a text on how to make these devices that's been lost to history. It's also unknown for who this device might have been made for. It isn't known if it was designed for a scholar, an astrologer, or if it was just designed as a plaything for someone rich to show off at parties. To date, we haven't found anything else from this period that is close to the Antikythera mechanism. It's the only ancient device from Greece that we found that uses gears. However, now that we know at least one of them exists, it's something that other people might be on the look for in future archaeological digs. Maybe we can even find one that wasn't corroded at the bottom of the sea for 2,000 years. But perhaps the even bigger question is, why didn't the ancient Greeks or anyone else follow up on this technology? Back in my episode about the bicycle, I asked the question, why didn't anyone invent the bicycle sooner? The question about the Antikythera mechanism is, why didn't anybody follow up on this? This question vexed the famous science fiction writer Arthur C. Clarke. He read The Theories of Price from 1959 and went to see the device himself in 1965. He said, quote, "Looking at this extraordinary relic is a most disturbing experience. Few activities are more futile than what-if type of speculation, yet the Antikythera mechanism positively compels such thinking. Though it is over 2,000 years old, it represents a level of achievement which our technology did not reach until the 18th century. If the insight of the Greeks had matched their ingenuity, the Industrial Revolution might have begun 1,000 years before Columbus. By this time, we would not be merely pottering around on the moon, we would have reached the nearest stars." End quote. We will probably never know the answer to those questions. Whoever built the Antikythera mechanism had the ability to create an actual working mechanical clock if they had only put a spring or a gravity device on it to turn it. As it stands, the Antikythera mechanism is perhaps the most out-of-place object that's ever been discovered. It would almost be like discovering a television set that dates back to the Renaissance. With this single device, we have been forced to reassess our knowledge and technical assessment of the entire ancient world.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and get your first month free. Just $1 down, $15 a month, no commitment. Deal ends Friday, February 13th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
In 1788, the son of the leader of the Confederation of Futa Jalan in West Africa was commanding his 2,000 troops against a neighboring military force when he was captured. He was sold into slavery and spent the next 40 years of his life living as a slave in Mississippi. That was until a chance meeting revealed his true identity, which eventually led to his freedom and the involvement of the President of the United States. Learn more about Abdulrahman Ibrahim Ibn Sori, the prince who became a slave whose emancipation became an international issue, on this episode of Everything Everywhere Daily. Over the 300-year history of the transatlantic slave trade, over 12.5 million people were forcibly taken from their homes in Africa and brought to the Americas. Of all of the people taken in the slave trade, almost none of them ever saw their freedom or returned home. Many of them never even made it across the ocean, as conditions in slave ships were so horrendous. To that extent, this episode's story is very much an aberration. It's the exception, not the rule. Abdulrahman Ibrahim Ibn Sori was born in 1762 in the town of Timbo in what is today the nation of Guinea in West Africa. He was born to one of the most noble and powerful families in all of West Africa at the time. His father was Emir Ibrahim Sori, the leader of the Islamic State of Futa Jalan in the highlands of central Guinea. He was a brilliant military leader who managed to build his kingdom after defeating several neighboring tribes. His firstborn son, Abdulrahman, was the heir apparent to Futa Jalan. As such, he was well-educated and trained. He attended the Islamic University in Timbuktu in what is today the nation of Mali. He studied philosophy and law and was reportedly fluent in four African languages as well as Arabic. He earned the title of Torodo, which was a 17th and 18th century term for West African Islamic clerics. When he returned home at the age of 21, he was given charge of a regiment of 2,000 soldiers in his father's army. It would probably have been the equivalent of a modern-day rank of a colonel. While out on campaign, he and his men were ambushed, and Abdul-Rahman was captured by a neighboring tribe. They then traded him to British slavers for muskets and rum, who sent him, along with so many other Africans, to the Americas. In 1788, at the age of 26, he wound up being purchased by a plantation owner in Natchez, Mississippi, by the name of Thomas Foster. At the time, Mississippi was still technically a Spanish territory. Foster's plantation at that time grew tobacco, because cotton had not yet become the staple crop for that region. When Abdul-Rahman arrived, he had his long hair cut, which was a symbol of his nobility, and was immediately put to doing hard labor. He did what you would expect. He escaped. I should note that in a later autobiography, he noted just how backwards and primitive he thought Natchez was when he first saw it, compared to what he had seen in places like Timbuktu. He survived 4 weeks on the run. However, he realized his predicament. He was in a foreign country, he had no allies, no money, and even if he could get to a port, he wouldn't be allowed to be on a ship back to Africa. He accepted his position that he wasn't a prince anymore and returned to Foster's plantation. His plan to ensure his survival was to make himself indispensable. And he did just that. Abdul-Rahman was far more educated and smarter than his owner, who was uneducated and illiterate. He also had a particular set of knowledge that made him particularly valuable. Abdul-Rahman was familiar with growing cotton, which was commonly grown back where he came from. Cotton was just starting to be grown in Mississippi, and he told Foster how to grow it. The plantation soon became the largest cotton producer in the region, and Abdul-Rahman soon found himself managing the entire operation. He was a natural leader, made his owner a lot of money, and as such was given certain liberties. He got married to a woman who worked on the plantation, who served as a doctor and midwife, and they had 9 children. He was also allowed to keep a vegetable garden and to sell his produce in town and keep the money. In 1807, almost 20 years after he arrived in Mississippi, he was selling his vegetables at the market when he had a chance encounter which changed the course of his life. It was there, in Natchez, Mississippi, Abdul-Rahman unexpectedly met the Irish surgeon, Dr. John Cox. Who, you might be asking, is Dr. John Cox? It turns out that decades earlier, Cox was serving as the surgeon on a British ship which sank off the coast of West Africa. Cox washed up on shore and was taken in by none other than Abdul-Rahman's father, Ibrahim Sori. Dr. Cox stayed with the family for 6 months as he regained his health. He was the first European to visit the town of Timbo and became acquainted with the young Abdul-Rahman. Both men were astonished to see each other, and Dr. Cox was especially astonished to find that this young man, a prince and member of the royal family, was a slave in Mississippi. Dr. Cox set it as his mission to free Abdul-Rahman, not only to end the injustice inflicted upon him, but also to repay the debt to his family who helped him so many years ago. Cox offered Foster to buy Abdul-Rahman's freedom, but he refused. He went as high as $1,000, which was a lot of money in 1807, but Foster still refused. Abdul-Rahman's plan of making himself invaluable had worked almost too well. He was so invaluable that Foster didn't want to let him go, as his whole operation was dependent upon him. The other thing Cox did was to provide an independent verification of Abdul-Rahman's story that he was in fact a prince. A story which, until that point, no one else really believed. The story of this chance encounter and of the prince who became a slave soon spread. A local newspaper reporter in Natchez named Andrew Marschalk interviewed Abdul-Rahman and found out that he spoke Arabic. The fact that he could speak, read, and write Arabic made Marschalk think that Abdul-Rahman must have been Moroccan. Abdul-Rahman didn't bother to correct him because, in the racial hierarchy of the South at the time, Moroccans were considered above West Africans, and this confusion about his homeland could help him get his freedom. Dr. Cox continued to fight for the freedom of Abdul-Rahman until his death in 1816, when the fight was picked up by his son. The fact that everyone thought he was Moroccan is an important point, because Morocco was the first country ever to sign a treaty with the young United States of America. That treaty guaranteed the protection of Moroccan subjects in the United States. Abdul-Rahman, being trained in law, became aware of the treaty and realized that this might be the loophole which could get him his freedom. The local newspaper man, Marschalk, helped Abdul-Rahman send a letter to the Sultan of Morocco saying how Abdul-Rahman wanted his freedom and to be reunited with his family in Morocco. Here I should note that while Guinea was far from Morocco, the Sultan of Morocco claimed an ancient protection over the Muslims of West Africa, especially royalty. Along with the letter, several pages of the Quran written in Arabic, transcribed by Abdul Rahman, were also sent with the letter to establish his credentials. By chance, the letter got to the Sultan, who petitioned the President of the United States, John Quincy Adams, for his release. The Sultan actually sent an emissary to Fuad Jallon to verify his claims and did in fact find out that he could be considered a Prince of the Moors. Secretary of State Henry Clay, not wanting to anger the United States' longest and first ally and cause an international incident, petitioned the President to free him. So on February 22, 1828, by order of the President of the United States, Abdul Rahman Ibrahim Ibn Sori was freed after 40 years of slavery. However, his now former owner insisted that upon his manumission, he leave for Africa immediately, as he didn't want him to enjoy the privileges of a free man in the United States. The story of Abdul Rahman spread throughout the country, and he took his time working his way up to Washington. People in cities along the way were fascinated by the story of the man who was a Moorish prince who became a slave. The reporter who helped arrange everything purchased a Moorish costume for him, which he could wear when he addressed crowds on his trip to Washington. Along the way, he earned enough money to free his wife, but not enough to free his children. When he got to Washington, D.C., he had a meeting with President Adams. From there, on March 18, 1829, he and his wife set sail to Liberia, which had become a colony of freed slaves who returned to Africa. Word was sent to Abdul Rahman's brother, who had taken over for his father when he died. He was overjoyed and sent a caravan to Liberia to meet his brother and to take him back home. He did make the journey to Africa, arriving in Liberia. However, on the journey back, he became ill, and 4 months after arriving, he died in Monrovia, Liberia in 1829 at the age of 67. In the end, he managed to raise enough funds to free two of his sons and their families, both of which moved to Liberia. There are two interesting footnotes to this story. One is that Thomas Gallaudet, the founder of the American School for the Deaf in Washington, D.C., took an interest in Abdul Rahman's story. Gallaudet was part of the American Colonization Society, which had a mission of spreading Christianity in Africa. He met with Abdul Rahman and asked him to show his commitment to Christianity by writing the Lord's Prayer in Arabic. Abdul Rahman just wanted to make more contacts with influential Americans to help free his family, so he obliged by writing it down on a piece of paper. Years later, after Abdul Rahman had gone back to Africa and passed away, they discovered that he in fact had not written down the Lord's Prayer in Arabic, but instead had written the first chapter of the Quran. The second footnote to the story has to do with his children, which he was unable to free. They obviously remained in America, but because they had what was now such a famous father, his legend and the story of his royal lineage was passed along from generation to generation. The descendants of Abdul Rahman Ibrahim Ibn Sori are still around today, and some of them have claimed royal status, consider themselves a royal family, and use royal titles. And some of them are still living around Natchez, Mississippi. Abdul Rahman Ibrahim Ibn Sori's case was used by abolitionist groups for decades to highlight the injustice of slavery. Long after slavery was abolished, his story has been remembered. He remains an inspiration as someone who kept his dignity and never lost hope, despite being denied his freedom for over 40 years. Everything Everywhere Daily is an Airwave Media podcast. The associate producers are Thor Thompson and Peter Bennett. Today's review comes from listener Sparky with iPod Touch over at Apple Podcasts in the United States. They write, "An excellent appetizer for everything. This show provides a wonderful introduction, or appetizer, to a cornucopia of different topics. It's not so in-depth as to get boring, but just enough information to let me decide if I want to know more or not, and gives me places to go find more, the main dish, if I want to, and even sometimes provides dessert in the way of personal experiences with some subject matters. Keep up the good work." Well, thanks, Sparky. Your username is interesting. Sparky is the nickname for the electric chair, which actually gives me an idea for a future episode. Also, I purchased an iPod Touch at the Apple Store in Tokyo in 2007, and it was one of the greatest purchases I had ever made at the time. Remember, if you leave a review or send me a Boostagram, you too can have it read on the show.